In 1997, Marco Pantani wrote up Alpe d'Huez, a climb with 21 hairpin bends and an average gradient over 8% in a little over 37 minutes, a time that stood as the unofficial benchmark for human climbing performance for the next 25 years. What almost nobody mentions when that record gets brought up is what else was happening in professional cycling in 1997, and why, for over two decades afterward, nobody could touch it. Not because riders got worse, but because the sport spent the following years trying to figure out how fast a human body can actually climb a mountain without help. That's the part most casual fans skip past when they watch the Tour de France and marvel at riders dancing up the Galibier or the Ventoux at speeds that look almost unnatural on a bike that weighs less than a bag of concrete. The assumption is simple. These are the most gifted athletes on Earth. Genetics did the heavy lifting, and years of brutal training turned that raw talent into the ability to climb a mountain faster than most of us could sprint down one on a motorcycle. Elite lungs, elite legs, elite willpower. Case closed. Except that explanation, while not wrong exactly, leaves out almost everything that actually decides how fast a climb gets ridden. And some of what it leaves out is a lot more uncomfortable than raw talent. Start with what's real and provable, because a huge amount of climbing speed genuinely does come down to biology and training that any of us could, in theory, replicate given the right coach and about a decade of suffering. Elite tour riders have some of the highest VO2 max scores ever recorded in human beings, values that measure how efficiently your body turns oxygen into usable energy, and they pair that with years of structured training that builds an almost absurd density of capillaries and mitochondria in their leg muscles, essentially turning their legs into more efficient engines than the rest of us are working with. None of that is a trick. It's a genuine physiological ceiling that most humans never get close to testing, built through thousands of hours most of us will never put in. But here's where the story most fans never hear starts, because raw fitness explains why these riders are fast in general. It doesn't explain why they got faster and faster through the 1990s, hit an almost impossible peak, and then, for years afterward, slowed back down even as training science kept improving. That shape doesn't match a story about genetics and hard work alone. It matches a story about what riders were putting into their bodies and when the sport finally started catching it. Go back to July 1998, the year after Pantani's Alpe d'Huez ride, and the Tour nearly collapsed entirely. A team car belonging to Festina, one of the strongest teams in the peloton, was stopped at the French border, stuffed with EPO, growth hormone, and testosterone, enough to supply an entire squad for the race. The scandal that followed, now simply called the Festina affair, forced several teams out, led to police raids on hotel rooms mid-race, and pulled back the curtain on something the peloton had quietly known for years. The climbing times fans were cheering for were being produced, in part by a drug that didn't make riders stronger, so much as it let them recover from unsustainable efforts as if they'd barely ridden at all. EPO, erythropoietin, boosts the number of oxygen-carrying red blood cells in your bloodstream, which sounds almost boring until you realize what it does to a climb. A rider on EPO isn't necessarily producing more raw power at any given moment. They're able to sustain something close to their absolute limit for far longer, attack after attack, day after day, in a race where the accumulated fatigue of 3 weeks usually decides who's still dancing on the pedals in week three and who's barely surviving. It turned 3 week grand tours into something closer to 3 weeks of fresh individual time trials up mountains, which is exactly the kind of performance that produces records nobody can naturally repeat. For years, testing simply couldn't catch it because EPO is a synthetic version of a hormone your body already produces naturally, so a blood test could only flag riders whose levels were implausibly high, not prove where those levels came from. That loophole is a huge part of why an entire era of climbing times sat on the books looking untouchable, and why so many of the riders who set them were later connected to doping investigations, court cases, or confessions, sometimes years after they'd retired, with their records still standing. The biggest name in that story is one most fans already know. Lance Armstrong won 7 consecutive Tour de France titles, built substantially on legendary mountain performances before the United States Anti-Doping Agency's 2012 investigation based on testimony from more than 24 witnesses, including his own former teammates, concluded his team ran what investigators called the most sophisticated doping program professional cycling had ever seen. He was stripped of all 7 titles. The climbs that made him a global icon were, according to that investigation, not simply the product of a gifted athlete pushing his limits. And Armstrong wasn't an isolated case in an otherwise clean era, which is part of what made the scandal so damaging. In 2006, Spanish police raided the offices of a doctor named Eufemiano Fuentes in an investigation that became known as Operación Puerto, uncovering blood bags, doping logs, and a client list that implicated dozens of riders across multiple teams and multiple nationalities, not just one team or one dominant champion. Several favorites were pulled from that year's Tour de France on the eve of the race, once their names surfaced. The pattern across both scandals was the same. Doping wasn't a handful of bad actors cutting corners. It was often built into how entire teams approach the sport's hardest mountain stages, which is exactly why the climbing records from that period carry an asterisk even for riders who were never personally caught. If you're the kind of rider who wants the version of these stories that doesn't stop at the highlight reel, subscribe to All About Cycle, because this is exactly the kind of digging this channel exists to do. Now, here's where it gets more complicated, not less. Because the sport didn't just get cleaner after Armstrong and Festina and quietly go back to normal. It got harder to read in a way that still shapes how people watch the tour today. In 2008, the UCI introduced the biological passport, a system that stopped chasing individual positive tests and instead tracked each rider's blood values over months and years, flagging suspicious patterns rather than single violations. It was a genuinely smarter approach, and it coincided with something measurable. Average climbing speeds on the sport's classic ascents actually slowed down. Pantani's Alpe d'Huez time from 1997 sat unbeaten for a generation, not because nobody since has been fit enough to threaten it, but because the riders capable of threatening it were now operating under a testing regime that made the old margins impossible to replicate cleanly. That gap between the doping era peaks and the post-passport reality is, honestly, one of the most revealing facts in the entire sport, and it rarely gets said out loud in TV commentary. Analysts and coaches often track a metric called VAM, vertical ascent meters per hour, essentially how many meters of pure elevation a rider climbs in 60 minutes, and it lets you compare wildly different mountains on a level playing field. Through the height of the EPO era, elite riders were regularly posting VAM figures that exercise physiologists considered close to the theoretical ceiling of human oxygen delivery, numbers so high that some scientists argued they weren't physiologically plausible without outside help at all. If the fastest climbs of all time came during the least tested era, and times measurably cooled once real testing arrived, then a huge share of what fans spent the 1990s and early 2000s treating as the outer limit of human climbing was never a clean baseline to begin with. The record itself was contaminated data, and cycling has spent 20 years trying to figure out what the honest number actually is. That uncertainty hasn't gone away either. In the 2020s, a new generation of dominant climbers started producing estimated power numbers, calculated by journalists and analysts from publicly available speed and gradient data rather than official team files that sit close to some of the figures flagged as suspicious during the EPO era. French journalist Antoine Vallière built an entire framework decades ago, sorting climbing performances into categories from human to miraculous, to what he bluntly labeled mutant, based on sustainable power-to-weight thresholds. And some of that same framework has been dusted off in recent years to question modern performances, even under a testing system that's dramatically more sophisticated than anything that existed in 1997. Nobody serious is claiming today's biological passport is being beaten the way EPO beat blood tests in the 90s. But the fact that the same statistical red flags keep reappearing generation after generation tells you the sport still hasn't fully separated the story of natural human limits from the story of what's chemically possible. So, where does that leave the genuinely legal, trainable side of climbing speed? The part that any ambitious amateur can actually learn from? Some of it comes from a philosophy British Cycling and Team Sky popularized in the 2000s under the label marginal gains. The idea that no single change makes a rider faster up a mountain, but dozens of tiny ones stacked together do. Altitude training camps that boost natural red blood cell production, the legal way, sleep tracking, custom nutrition timed to the exact demands of a stage, even hand-picked pillows on team buses, all aimed at squeezing out fractions of a percent that add up over a 3-week race. It's less dramatic than a doping scandal, but it's genuinely one of the reasons modern riders can produce strong, sustainable efforts without the shortcuts that defined the sport a generation earlier. It starts with weight, obsessively managed weight. Elite climbers ride at body compositions. Most sports medicine doctors would consider borderline extreme because on a sustained climb, every kilogram is dead weight, fighting gravity the entire way up. And the difference between a rider at 400 and a rider at 420 watts matters far less than the difference between a rider who weighs 60 kilograms and one who weighs 68. That relationship, watts divided by body mass, is the single number that predicts climbing performance better than almost anything else, which is why Grand Tour climbers are some of the leanest athletes in any professional sport on Earth, often to a degree that raises its own separate health concerns team doctors have flagged for years. Then there's equipment, which the UCI has deliberately capped rather than letting run wild. Since 2000, the governing body has enforced a minimum bike weight of 6.8 kilograms, specifically because manufacturers and teams were racing toward frames so light, they raised real safety concerns, and that rule means climbing bikes today are often built heavier than engineers could otherwise make them, with weight added back in strategically for stiffness and aerodynamics rather than shaved off entirely. Riders aren't winning climbs because their bikes got infinitely lighter. They're winning because everything else around that fixed minimum weight, aerodynamic tube shapes, tire pressure, even climbing position, got refined instead. And finally, there's pacing, which sounds unglamorous compared to doping scandals, but genuinely changed how climbs get ridden. Power meters became standard equipment across the peloton through the 2000s, giving riders and directors a real number to pace against instead of pure feel. And modern race radios let team cars feed real-time data straight to a rider's ear mid-climb. That combination turned climbing from an art of reading your own suffering into something closer to an engineered effort curve, where a rider holds a specific number for a specific duration, because the data says that's the fastest way to the top without blowing up. Older generations of climbers, riders like Eddy Merckx or Miguel Indurain, rode largely on instinct and feel, often mashing bigger gears at lower cadence. The modern style, popularized in part by Armstrong's own team, before the scandal broke, favors spinning smaller gears at a noticeably higher cadence, which reduces peak muscular strain on any single pedal stroke and lets a rider hold a hard effort longer. A genuine technical evolution that had nothing to do with what was or wasn't in anyone's bloodstream. So, the honest verdict on why tour riders climb the way they do. Some of it is completely legitimate and worth admiring, without asterisks. Rare physiology sharpened by years of training, obsessive weight management, smarter gearing, and pacing turned into something close to a science. That part of the story deserves the offhand's gibbet. But the fastest climbing times in the sport's history didn't emerge from a clean baseline, and the sport's own testing history proves it, because times slowed measurably the moment testing got serious, and the same statistical red flags analysts used to spot doping in the 90s keep reappearing on today's biggest climbs. Neither the cynical version that it's all still fake, nor the innocent version that it's simply human excellence, survives contact with the actual data. What most cyclists get wrong isn't underestimating how gifted these riders are, it's assuming the record book represents a clean, stable measure of human limits at all, when a huge chunk of it was set during the exact years the sport was least equipped to catch what was really happening. And a lot of that inflated baseline is still what casual viewers unconsciously compare every new performance against. Next time you watch a climb and a commentator casually compares it to a time from the 90s, remember that comparison is measuring two completely different eras of testing, not two, comparable efforts, and treat any climb that suddenly rewrites the record books with the same healthy skepticism the sport itself has finally learned to apply. If this changed how you watch a mountain stage, subscribe to All About Cycle, because next time we're going inside the technology arms race that's quietly reshaping the sport in an entirely different direction. Ride safe.